Okay, people, I'm Danny Schechter, your News Dissector. It's time for News Dissector Radio here on the Progressive Radio Network. Be here. Stay with us. Check it out.
In the entire planet that are more unequal than the United States in the distribution of our wealth.
This is corrupt!
Bankers, corporations throw the country into the gutter like dice. Whatever comes up, they win. Politicians are paid off to keep the game running. There's just no way you're going to be competitive in a rigged game.
This is corrupt!
Some of the best people we have will never get a shot.
Your Occupy collage, your Occupy song, it's so powerful. Cat Waters is in the studio with me for this week's edition of News Dissector Radio here on PRN-FM. And you can reach us at 888-874-4888. We want to get right to it today. We're really thrilled that Glenn Greenwald of Salon is here to join us. We have a lot more coming up on the program, including the director of the Left Forum, Seth Adler, will be joining us a little bit later. Giannis, who's from Greece, who will talk to us about the crisis in Greece as well. So we have a lot to talk about. And I also want to give you a brief report on my speech earlier this week to the UN in Geneva, Switzerland, talking about the global financial crisis as a human rights issue. It hasn't been really raised as such. I raised it, and I'll tell you what happened in a moment or two. Hi, Glenn. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Okay. Any way of bringing up Glenn's audio just a bit? Anyway, Glenn Greenwald has been writing, in my view, brilliantly about the way our, you know, mainstream, lamestream, call it what you will, media has been playing this game with Iran, basically escalating fears, paranoia, tension, seems to be preparing a war against Iran. Can you talk to us a little bit about your observations of how this is happening, what this process is?
It certainly seems pretty similar to what we saw in the run-up to the war in Iraq, which is there is a country that the United States claims is developing weapons that at some point in the future could somehow pose a threat to the United States. There's no hardcore evidence that Iran is developing a nuclear weapon, just like there was no evidence that Iraq was developing a nuclear weapon. And even if they were developing a nuclear weapon, the United States doesn't have the right to go around simply attacking other countries that aren't attacking it or threatening to attack it or imminently about to attack it. And yet there seems to be this concerted effort, not so much on the part of the government, but on the part of factions within the United States and the American media, to depict Iran as this grave menace and threat to the United States and to encourage people to think that military action against it is necessary.
There has been, though, an escalation in the name of diplomacy, although the diplomacy usually implies some sort of interaction, some sort of conversation, some sort of dialogue, some sort of discourse. But in the name of diplomacy, there has been this imposition of sanctions. And tomorrow, a new financial sanction is being slapped on Iran. Basically, they can't use the SWIFT system, which is the international system of financial exchange within banks. The consequence of that is likely to be more strangulation of the economy in Iran. I mean, this seems like an act of war in some respects.
Well, that's the sort of perverse aspect of thinking about sanctions is diplomacy. Diplomacy means sitting down with another country when you have a dispute with it and working out a peaceful resolution. That was what President Obama vowed somewhat controversially to do when he was running for president, which was to sit down with the leaders of the various countries with which the United States has had longstanding disputes in an effort to resolve those disputes amicably and peacefully. And yet, with very little exception, a little bit of gesture at the beginning of the Obama presidency, the United States more or less has been unwilling to negotiate with Iran, to actually engage in diplomacy. Obama's own advisor for Iran, who resigned several months ago, gave an interview a couple of weeks ago, Vali Nasr, and he basically said that the real failing of our Iran policy is that the United States has made no effort to negotiate. And there's all this talk of war, which is amazing, without any effort to diplomatically resolve it. Sanctions are the opposite of diplomacy, as you suggested. The United States famously killed several hundred thousand Iraqi women, children, and innocent men in the late 1980s and early 1990s through the sanction regime that was imposed on that country. And now there's starting to be widespread food shortages and other severe economic suffering that the Iranian citizens are experiencing as a result of these sanctions, and it's not really achieving much. I mean, to try and collapse a country's currency and harm its economy is, as you said, an act of war, not an act of diplomacy.
Yeah, let me just jump in for a quick second here, Glenn, because, first of all, let's remind people about what you were saying before, the use of sanctions, and the reports that, as many as a million Iraqi children had been killed. And Madeleine Albright, our then Secretary of State, was interviewed, I guess, on 60 Minutes and asked if she felt that was worth it. And she said she did, callously. Essentially not wanting to know about the consequences. Sanctions are supposedly being aimed at governments that we don't like. We want to hurt those governments, but it's the people who are suffering them. I just came back from Iran. I was there in February, and people are, talking about the difficulties that they're already beginning to experience. And these people, in many cases, are against the Iranian government. These are the people who are out in the streets in the Green Revolution calling for more democracy. And they're the ones who the United States and the other Western countries that are part of this so-called sanctions regime are actually hurting. And yet the consequences of that seems to be downplayed in our media, where the most strident voices, and particularly the voices of the Israeli lobby, are heard the loudest.
Well, I would challenge anybody to even try and find a discussion in the establishment American media about the effects on ordinary Americans from the escalating sanctions regime, which the United States is imposing along with its Western allies on that country. It's virtually impossible to find. It's almost as though sanctions is sort of like collateral damage. It's a word that just exists without any thought given to what it actually means in terms of human suffering. It is really designed to obfuscate the human suffering that our policies are causing. And what's so ironic about that is that whenever you hear people who want to push the United States toward greater hostilities with Iran talk about the oppressive Iranian government. I'm sorry?
No, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yeah, what you'll hear is people pretending that they care so much about the Iranian people and this is just about wanting to protect and bring freedom to the Iranian people. And yet at the same time, the very policies that the United States and those individuals are advocating and pursuing are doing more to harm the Iranian people than anything else.
It's so predictable, isn't it, that the most extreme right-wing forces in Iran are the ones who are the beneficiaries, the supreme ruler of the most recent election, the president who we've been basically presented, who's been presented to the American people as a goofball, if not an insidious hater of Israel and the like, seems to be emerging as the liberal in this debate. Other voices are not even being heard. And, we're being given this message basically of demonization of the Iranian, government of the country of Iran, bomb, 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 bomb Iran. Wasn't that John McCain's little ditty in the election of 2008?
Well, that's, of course, the core irony here is that the way in which this is all being accomplished is to depict the Iranians, the government and the nation generally as this aggressive threat. The reality, of course, is that it's the United States that has bombed and invaded and occupied multiple countries in that region. If you look at a map, you'll see that American military bases are located within almost every single country within the near vicinity of Iran. We have them almost completely encircled. There's a huge fifth naval fleet right across the Persian Gulf situated in Bahrain. And so
what incidentally, a country where we've seen revolts, basically underreported revolts by people against an oppressive, king there, and an unrepresentative government, which gets no attention in part because our military naval base is there somehow. They're our, quote, ally. And, you know, the media seems to fall in line. Even Al Jazeera, which is, been a source of information, is being criticized for not sufficiently covering Bahrain because of the kind of policies of the Qatar government. So, how do we get the truth?
Well, I mean, one of the things that, of course, the internet and other technologies permit, including satellite technologies and the like, is to be able to go far afield of establishment American media outlets in order to get information. So you can go online and you can read alternative media outlets through the internet. You can listen to radio programs like this. You can go watch new television news stations in the Muslim world that present alternative views. There, it's much, much easier to find alternative points of view and alternative news outlets now than it was even a decade ago as a result of this technology.
Press TV from Iran is available online, but not on any stations here. Al Jazeera is available in a few cities, not very many, has been fighting an uphill battle to try to get seen in the United States, where it's seen all over the world. RT, Russia Today, is on the air more and has also been a source of all kinds of independent and alternative information. Of course, Democracy Now!, your own columns in Salon are brilliant contributions to all this. Let me ask you a question for a reflection now as opposed to an opinion. Many of us who voted for Barack Obama in 2008 believed somehow that he would be able to make the change he was promising, would be able somehow to stand up for certain principles that were different than the principles of the Bush administration and people in power. We've seen that not to be the case. What is it about our system? What is it that seems to capture our politicians and turn them into replications of each other and sort of people who express the same ideology, the same message points, the same slogans and all the rest of it, whether they be Democrats or Republicans? Why does that happen? What is it about our system that seems to encourage that?
Well, that's, a really important and complex question. I think, to some extent it assumes, and I'm not sure the assumption is fully accurate, that people like Barack Obama or others are actually committed in the first instance to undermining these forces and to bringing about real change and then get into office and find that they're unable to do it or get co-opted. I think a big part of it has to do that with the fact that people who tend to be politicians and who are successful in running for high office tend to be people who, by definition, are interested in accommodating power and perpetuating the status quo rather than really undermining or subverting it, and that the promises to bring about change are really just branding tactics rather than they are genuine conviction. But, beyond that, if you look back at 50 years ago at Dwight Eisenhower's farewell address, and obviously Dwight Eisenhower was no radical, he was a five-star general and a two-term Republican president. He warned about exactly what you've asked about, which is that there are factions in Washington that are beyond democratic accountability and that exist without regard to the outcome of elections. He called it the military-industrial complex and said that it was becoming so powerful that it could dictate policy more potently than even the president of the United States, and it's only gotten infinitely more potent and less transparent since then. And you have the sort of parallel corporatist class that controls Washington. So you have this ongoing permanent power faction in Washington that really does wield far more power than any single elected official.
So if you had to synthesize, if some, you know, high school student came up to you, Glenn, you know, and said, Mr. Greenwald, could you help me? I have an assignment from my teacher. Who rules America? Your answer?
Yeah, you know, I think it's the people who are the oligarchs, the people who exercise the greatest amounts of financial wealth. And there's all kinds of reasons for that. And, you know, that's not overwhelmingly new, but they have a lot less constraints than they ever had in the past. And they have tools at their disposal as well. And I think, you know, it's sort of the oligarchs control, exercise a great deal of influence in Washington. And then I think the sort of secretive under national security state of, you know, the CIA and private contractors, and that entire sprawling, what the Washington Post called top secret America, exercises great power in the foreign policy and the national security context.
Well, this is an issue I think we want to get back to go kind of peel, you know, a couple of layers off the top here, you know, of the assumptions that most of us have about who really has power. I mean, one of the issues, and I'll be closing on this point with you, Glenn, because of, you know, however screwed up our communications were, I wasn't able to lock you in for a longer period, a conversation I'd really like to have with you, because I'm a great fan of your work, and I think your insight and skill as a writer really helps clarify all of this. But it seems to me we do need to look more closely at this whole question about power and who exercises it and how we can confront it, because, you know, I used to, you know, complain a lot during the days of the Iraq demonstrations. Everybody would march on the White House and yell at Bush, you know, Bush, 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 he did it, you know. And, you know, 10 blocks away was the Washington Post. Nobody marched on them. So it seems to me when we talk about the military-industrial complex, we got to add the media to that complex, and maybe even the Internet these days, or the surveillance of the Internet, as being part of you know, this whole structure of power that seems to quash, you know, people who are interested in alternatives, who want to raise deeper questions and find a way to push them off and push them to the side. And that's what this network is trying to challenge in its own way. And many of us who are bloggers and writers are trying to do as well. You know, your own work seems to inspire a lot of support. How do you feel as a writer? Do you feel like you're having an impact, or enough of an impact?
Well, I mean, you always want more of an impact if you believe in the rightness of your own views. But I do believe in the power of the Internet and technology to amplify voices that even a short time ago would have been much more easily excludable from mainstream discussion. I think the Internet enables people to build up large audiences, as I've done, of people who are like-minded, so that you can work together to force these kind of ideas into the discourse. But ultimately, I think the most important thing is, in terms of the question that you asked about who runs things and wields real power, you know, the reason why these things are kept hidden is because they operate in the dark without any transparency or light being shined on them. And I think the first prerequisite is to blow a hole in the wall of secrecy behind which all of these things are conducted. And that's the reason why, for example, I was such a supporter of WikiLeaks. It's why I think that it's so important to have people devoted to shining lights on them, whether online or on radio or on different kinds of television networks. Because in order to first get people to realize that they need to work against it, people need to realize how it works. And I do think inroads are being made. It's why I think internet freedom is so vital. And there's obviously a lot more work to do. But yeah, I do think progress has been made in that regard.
Well, thank you so much for occupying my radio show this afternoon here on Progressive Radio Network. We'd love for you to come back on. The issues that we've touched on really need to be debated and discussed some more, and I appreciate your coming on. Glenn Greenwald writes for Salon.com and is really someone who has stood up on this WikiLeaks issue in a not just a one shot, but in a regular, ongoing, follow-up, systematic way. And we all thank you for that. Thanks so much, Glenn.
Thanks for having me. Happy to come back anytime.
Great. And Kat Waters has been dying to make a comment, make a statement. Please jump in.
Well, yeah, just on the comment that Gary just made.
Glenn,
sorry, you know, about exposing this stuff. I mean, that's exactly what we have to do. And so many people, they want to point the finger at the people that are exposing this stuff. Like, they're the problem and, you know, like, they're bad for talking about this negative stuff. You know, I mean, we have to overcome that and we have to, like, welcome the people that are actually, like, getting themselves dirty.
Well, I agree with that. Obviously, I wouldn't be doing this program. It's difficult sometimes to do it. Guests confirm. They drop away. They don't communicate. Whatever. But, you know, we had Glenn on and we'll have him back. You heard him. Make a solemn pledge on News Dissector Radio a few minutes ago, and we hope we'll be able to have him on for a longer conversation. Joining us now, this is the man who was stepping up to the plate when Glenn didn't seem as if Glenn would be coming on. Yiannis is an economist. He's Greek. He's been monitoring a lot of the developments in Greece, which is a very important situation that we need to know more about. He's also going to be speaking at the Left Forum with me on a panel at 3 o'clock tomorrow, a Saturday at Pace University, which is 31 Park Row, Spruce Street. Along the side is where the entrance is. Yanni, are you there?
Yes, Danny, how are you?
Thank you for joining us. I'm sorry this has been out of my control in some ways. We've been trying desperately to kind of impose order on chaos. We're doing a bit of a good job of it, but not enough. Yanni, excellent. Just bring us up to date on what's happening in Greece, because here's a country that's been on the front lines of the fight against austerity, the fight for economic justice, and it seems as if it's losing, or is it?
Well, it depends. It's on our hands. The problem, Danny, is that austerity is sold as a remedy, as a medicine to some of the malfunctions of the Greek economy. So they sugarcoat a pill that's actually a poison. That's the real fallacy, and I'm afraid that the Greek people have been, they have accepted the blame of something they didn't do or they didn't consciously authorize, and now they are gonna. It looks like they are gonna have to bite the poisonous pill. What we have here in Greece is actually a direct case of a feudal takeover of the country. Only that term is not really kosher in the language of the 1%. So they call it as restructuring, as sanitizing the economy, as cutting the fat. But actually, that's all of that language that's been perpetuated for the past 2 years. Is actually can be encoded in one word as with two words: feudalist takeover.
Yeah, when we say feudalistic, we mean that the debt is now being paid off by the people who didn't incur the debt in the first place. The debt has been slapped on the heads of the Greek people, who are basically giving up their jobs, giving up their livelihoods, suffering tremendously because other forces have imposed this on them. First, it was the hedge funds and the Wall Street guys who were shoveling money into Greece. Then they demanded that they get all their money back. They haven't gotten it all back, but they've demanded that. Then Germany stepped in and basically started dictating to Greece what Greece could and couldn't do. The EU seemed to have joined that chorus, and the Greek people who, you know, this is a country that created democracy, people. This is not a country that's
right
in Mars somewhere. This is the country we have to thank for the whole Western tradition of democracy.
Right.
Am I right, Yanni?
You're absolutely right. Actually, Danny, yesterday I gave a talk to the United Federation of Teachers, and because March 25th is the commemoration of the modern Greek independence, the revolution that led to the modern Greek state, and that event is taught to us as a token of bravery, of sacrifice, of achievement, of freedom and liberation. However, there is a very, very pecuniary like caveat that actually upsets this whole narrative, and that has to do with the so-called euphemistically called the independence loans that Greece signed actually before it even became independent, and actually they started in 1824. And they basically put Greece under slavery, debt slavery, for 166 years. Now, you mentioned Germany. Germany, I think they are massively projecting when they are accusing that Greece, or they're spreading fear, Greece is not going to pay, Greece, or, you know, all this like narrative, fear narrative towards the market, because Germany is the... Germany is a country that has had its debts forgiven. Greece, even though it has usurious debt imposed on it for like almost like two centuries now, Greece paid it actually. That independence loans from since 1824, it took Greece 166 years to pay it, but Greece did pay it.
This is just fascinating. I mean, who knew about this going back to the days of independence of Greece? I mean, you know, what you're pointing to really is the poor contextualization and background in our own media. It doesn't help people really understand the background, how something actually happened and what it means. And as a consequence, people join in, say, the Greek people, they've been so irresponsible. Do you know that these people have retirement plans? Do you know that these people have a railroad? Do you know that, in other words, everything that Greece has created is being turned around as a sign that the Greek people sort of have stolen something that doesn't belong to them, and then they're being blamed for it. And this is what's so hideous in the coverage. And to hear you speak, and I love your accent, Yanni, I mean, you know, it really helps us understand another perspective. And this is not a perspective of, you know, Kony in Uganda, you know, somewhere in the Lord's Resist. This is a country in Europe. This is a country that created democracy. And yet most Americans don't have a clue about what's behind all of this, and our media makes sure that they don't have a clue. And that's what's so fascinating to me. And we're going to continue. Can you stay with us a little bit?
Absolutely.
Because we're going to be coming back. Seth Adler of the Left Forum is going to be joining us to tell folks a little bit more, we hope, about what's happening with the Left Forum. Yanni and I and Catherine will continue this discussion. And please stay with us here on News Dissector Radio on PRN FM, the place to turn for information that is not available in many other places.
To chase and to Wachovia, Wells Fargo, Sally Mae, to MasterCard and Citibank, and also B of A.
Schechter, your News Dissector here, back on the News Dissector Radio Hour with Cat Waters. Yanni will be coming back in a minute, but first I want you to meet Seth Adler. Seth somehow swoops into New York this time of year and somehow helps create, put together the alchemy that becomes the Left Forum. Trying to weigh the, you know, demands of hundreds of organizations and coming up with an event with 1,400 speakers and all sorts of panels. How's it going, Seth, this year?
Hi, it's going really good. There's a lot of people down here, and as you said, it is alchemy, isn't it? I mean, you see it each year, too, and you wonder, you know, sort of this phenomenon in New York City of people from the most diverse backgrounds in the progressive to radical movements coming together and doing these panels and workshops and tracks of panels. And then we've got the big plenary speakers with folks that people know much better. Michael Moore is on Saturday. Wally Shawn is doing something on Sunday. Chris Hedges is here on Sunday night. Stanley Aronowitz and so many others. You know, I can't even say all the names. Usually in the years, Danny, I get to memorize at least half of the names, but this time with 1,400 speakers, it's really something that's sort of like an explosive, but a wonderfully explosive event.
But the program is like a Yellow Pages. It's like a phone book. It's gigantic. There's so much to go and to see and to do. And yet, at the same time, is there a danger here of sort of the left talking to itself, having a rally in the guise of an intellectual, debate, and basically nothing much happening until next year, same time, same station. In other words,
right.
I'm not being cynical here. I mean, I'm all for discourse.
You're absolutely right. One of the wonderful things about a forum, a place of dialogue, a place of challenge, is there's debate. There's you and others who bring up points in dialogue that we need to hear, that people need to discuss. Even the phrase you use, the left, is in contention at this conference, because really there is no the left from at least one perspective. There are many, many different traditions, religious justice, anarchist, socialist, communist, community organizations. We go on and on with all of these, what could be said to be these different sort of areas of social and political engagement where people don't even always use the term right and left. So it is a forum where even the framing of it as an expectation for a the in the left gets deconstructed and worked over. And, you know, we could say that's helpful.
In many ways. I think one of the things that is new that 2 years ago, I think I talked to you about this idea of let's take the whole left forum and march on Wall Street, you know, which is just down the block, you know, and make a statement and, you know, getting anything like that introduced at the last minute, you know, when everybody is like waiting for their precious, you know, airtime to give their talks, you know, that they've been preparing for a year, was a non-starter. Yeah. But Occupy Wall Street did emerge. And one of the things about it that seems so unusual, and in a way one of its strengths, perhaps one of its weaknesses, is that many different ideas are welcomed, including libertarians, including the Ron Paul people, including people who are not really identified with the left, but who are identified with change and changing America. And what's been, you know, pretty interesting so far is that we haven't had the intense factionalism that you often see on the left, sectarianism, denouncing, you know, the incorrect ones by the correct ones, etc., but more of a discourse.
Yeah, you know, what's exactly the level of trust that's built up in the various social movements that identify with the word occupation, Occupy Wall Street and Occupy the Hood and so forth, is a wonderful thing to behold, and partly that consensus and affinity structure that has emerged has made it very clear to a huge swath of the American public that this is a place I can go to express my political concerns where I can't say it much elsewhere. And, you know, it's infused into the left forum because, in many ways, early on, the Occupy Poetry Assembly, the Occupy Think Tank, the Food and Sustainability Groups, the Education and Empowerment Groups, one after another were saying, so the left forum is a place where we can engage in a different type of dialogue, but also extend what we do into the very nature of this open space, this convergent space, this conference. And indeed, Danny, as you've looked down the 400 panels, it's the amount of diverse Occupy organizers and long-term occupiers from Alaska to North Carolina and from really around the world, because we've got Greek and other folks connected to these.
You hear that, Yanni?
Yes. Yeah. We've even got the occupation spirit on the plenaries, because for a long time, Marina Citrin, she's in the legal working group of Occupy Wall Street, has been one of the plenary speakers, but also has been a basis of broadening out the reach of her networks into Left Forum, and she's on the opening plenary. And on the closing plenary, we've got the person who's articulated the social movement of indigenous people around the world and the occupations probably longer than anybody else. This is John Holloway. He's in Mexico now, coming up to do the closing plenary. Also, David Graeber. People may know that David has written on debt, and he's doing things here on debt, but he also was one of the inspirers of the occupation. So it's wonderful to see the Left Forum in it activist motion having these influences and components this year. It's partly why there are 1,400 speakers, because occupations really came and said, this is a place that we want to be, and we want to help build our movements, which also speaks to your question, the all-important question of, you know, what is politically sort of practical? What is practice compared to sort of the cogitation and the thought and the endless debate and so forth? And, you know, you've seen that shift, too, in the Left Forum over the years as it becomes more and more community group-oriented. There's more and more of that sort of, here we are strategically talking about and advancing with the unions, well, for example, what we're doing.
Well, Seth, you'll be very pleased to know, although I don't know who else will be, that I will be participating in at least one panel tomorrow afternoon at 3 o'clock on media ethics. I've written a book on Occupy Wall Street as well, which I hope to be talking about in some way with folks that are there. But, you know, I've looked forward to these panels. Sometimes I find it a bit overwhelming, a bit overloaded, a bit, you know, in a way, even competitive between various groups. On the other hand, it seems like you've really tried to be inclusive and to open this up because, you know, obviously this has been one of the big problems of the left, which is only speaking to the left, not reaching beyond it to other constituencies, other communities, you know, other classes even sometimes. You know, if the academic elite is sort of dominating things, often this intimidates or turns off people who are dealing with more mundane concerns.
Yes, it is very much what you've seen, the inclusiveness, so that now this year in the area of the prison industrial complex and confronting and trying to address what the hell to do about a really dire situation that these institutions of crime and punishment, so-called, really are not that, but they're more like, really in sectors for housing populations in forms of control that are inhuman. There are like 30 panels, and you could say they're competitive, but these folks are networking with each other before the conference to have panels that are both different from each other and that are linked in time to each other. And so you've got this emergent phenomenon.
Let me just jump in for a second and say this is most cool. I appreciate it. I only would take 10 minutes of your time. You and I could go on for an hour and just get started, basically discussing all this stuff. So thanks for coming on. We always like to promote the Left Forum here on this program. And, you know, and I've had some positive experiences, also some critical thoughts about it. But I'll be hanging out and hope to give you a high five there, Seth. And thank you again for your work.
Good. Dandy, you've told people to come on down to Pace it right across the street from City Hall Park. It's open to all. The registration is phenomenally low, almost non-existent. We really want people enjoying this experience while it lasts, because it's only 2.5 days. Starting right now. They can come now.
Starting right now. Thank you, Seth, very much. Catherine, comment.
Well, I was just going to say, I think Michael Moore and Chris Hedges would, like your idea of taking the Left Forum out down to Wall Street, being is that Michael Moore was down there making his documentary, asking for people. He had his crime tape around Wall Street and, was like, where is everybody? You know, why am I down here by myself? So, you know, maybe we can, join him this time.
Well, the hope is that this spring there will be a revival. Yanni, are you still with us?
Absolutely. And yeah. I would like to echo Seth's comments that actually the Left Forum, in a truly, you know, a Marxist sense, it's a dialectic forum where actually there is no thesis, there is thesis and antithesis, and hopefully we're going to synthesize into something constructive and something that can lead society and the body politic into, you know, a concrete and meaningful action. Speaking of myself, of course, I'm very pleased to be speaking tomorrow on Occupy Ethics with you and Anne Kleiesen from the New York Ethical Society. And then on Sunday, I also have two morning forums. One is on Occupy the Commons with Marty Rowland and Gabriel Eng. And then at noon, we have a sustainability forum. You see, all these three forums, they are, they touch three different important aspects of the current discourse. Ethics, the commons, and then how do you create on the ground sustainable initiatives to occupy the economy. So all of that, the Left Forum provides an excellent, place to do and, bring people together and bounce ideas and echo ideas. It's good sometimes to see other people that think like you. It's very invigorating and it gives you an extra impetus to continue what you are doing. And it's a fabulous venue.
I think it's not just like, we've had forums, we've had academic colloquiums, we've had conferences. But, in a way, Occupy has transformed the terms of all of this, because here was a small group of people who basically moved into a park in Lower Manhattan that nobody really had heard of. They were ignored by the media at first. They were then made fun of by the media. And then slowly, it exploded into a worldwide global phenomenon. In 6 weeks, there were protests in 1,000 cities. This is unheard of. And I think it resonates. People want to do something. Maybe the cold, maybe the frustration. There have been thousands of people arrested. This is a mass movement. This is not something that's a minor effort. Just yesterday, a cat was at a protest against Bank of America. What was that like?
It was really good. A couple of hundred people showed up at the waterfront where everyone met. The weather wasn't like that bad, but it was not raining at least. And first we marched and stopped in front of Moody's, where everyone was pretty much, directing anger at them for
the ratings service, by the way, which is about to, according to the New York Times today, Britain is about to lose its AAA rating.
Yelling at them to downgrade Bank of America. And, people mic checked a lot of the facts, the factual Bank of America borrowed like $1 trillion from the Fed and then gave themselves like $4.4 billion bonus. I mean, I have videos. If anybody wants to go to my YouTube channel, it's Cat Waters 4. I have tons of videos. I took a whole bunch yesterday. And then we ended up at like a local Bank of America, not too far away.
Years ago, I don't know if anybody listening can remember this, since I am not just in the 99%, but sometimes I feel like I am 99, there were the protests against the Bank of America at the University of California and in Santa Barbara, and they actually burned down the Bank of America. And their slogan at the time was, "Don't bank on America with 3 Ks in America." I mean, that was back in the 60s. So Bank of America has been a target of activists because of its policies. Speaking of which, the New York Times today introduces a new term into the discourse in reference to Bankers Trust back in 93 and 94. They had a term called ROF. Do you know what that is, Cap? ROF.
No.
it stands for ripoff factor. The bank actually had a ripoff factor in its calculations about how it was going to rip off its own clients. Okay, and this is part of what this guy Greg Smith was saying at Goldman Sachs, that you know, basically they're not there to help their clients, they're there to rip them off in one way or another.
At least they factored it in. I mean, you know, like, I mean, most of the time the accounting is so bad they don't even make it part of the equation.
How do you feel that fits into an ethical scheme, Yanni? ROF.
Well, I mean, personally, I'm not that much against that. I'm against, though, the lack of transparency, the fact that we violated any common sense of free markets and true capitalism, and we didn't allow one of the counterparties, the client, to know what his business partner, Bank of America, for that matter, or Goldman Sachs, have in mind. It's a lack of transparency. We talk about free markets, but we don't have the premise for free markets. That's the fallacy that we have to bring out, because that's manifestly unethical. It's like me playing with you poker, and I don't know that you have eight aces up your sleeves.
Those aces? I get what you're saying. You know, obviously, my only point is, I think because of Occupy Wall Street, suddenly issues like financial fraud and deception are becoming more public and more open for debate and discourse. I was hoping to just comment on earlier this week Tuesday, I was in Geneva, Switzerland, at the Human Rights of process, where the NGO organizations were holding various open hearings, and I was invited to address this particular group to deal with the global financial crisis as a human rights issue. And I gave a talk there. Ramsey Clark, U.S. Attorney General, was there. So was Sarah Flounders from the United States. But there were NGO people from all over the world. And I was able to speak there about why I see this crisis as a human rights disaster for people who have lost their jobs, lost their homes, lost their hope through no fault of their own. They didn't do it. It was done to them. And yet, in our country, there's been so few prosecutions of the big cheeses here. There's been so little efforts to protect the public against these abuses. And I began my speech by referencing a phrase from a Harvard Business School professor named Shoshana Zuboff, who back in 2009 argued that crimes against humanity had been committed by Wall Street's financial manipulators by refusing to consider the consequences of their actions. Those who created the financial crisis exemplify the banality of evil, she wrote. Each day's economic news leaves me haunted by Hannah Arendt's ruminations on Nazi war criminal Adolf Eichmann, as she reported on his trial in Jerusalem 45 years ago. Arendt pondered the strange interdependence of thoughtlessness and evil and sought to capture it with her famous formulation, the banality of evil. She found Eichmann, and this is significant, neither perverted nor sadistic, but terribly and terrifyingly normal. And that phrase could be applied to many of the banksters that we are now confronting.
Absolutely. Danny, I would like to expand it. What I've been saying is actually we commit crime against the unborn generations, because with the system of creative accounting that we do, the only way that the current debt system, debt finance economy, can function is if we factor in today production that will happen and has not yet happened in 30, 40, 50 years ahead. So basically, we are eating the bread of the future generations, and that's manifestly unethical and manifestly anti-human rights and manifestly anti-democratic, because we didn't ask the future generations, the unborn generations, for their permission to eat their bread.
You know, in my talk, I talked about how all of this was defended on the grounds that everyone was doing it. Therefore, no one was responsible, and everyone is to blame, and at the same time, no one is to blame. And it took the editor of Vanity Fair, a magazine more into celebrities than derivatives, to dispose of this perverse lack of logic. I'd like to conclude with this. Greeden Carter wrote, "It can fairly be said that the chain of catastrophic bets made over the past decade by a few hundred bankers may well turn out to be the greatest nonviolent crime against humanity in history. They've brought the world's economy to its knees, lost tens of millions of people their jobs and their homes, trashed the retirement plans of a generation, and they could drive an estimated 200 million people worldwide into dire poverty. In other words, never before have so few done so much to so many." Final word, Kat.
The only way this is going to change is when the people really realize what they're dealing with and how completely psychopathological the people with all the power truly are. And as long as we, the 99% keep trying to deal with them or speak to them like we would speak to one another, the same thing's going to just keep happening, because they're so manipulative. They're so always going to be pointing it back to us, making it feel like it's us. And if we don't just...
You're not taking responsibility on this program once and for all for the whole financial crisis?
You have to put
Didn't you do it, Catherine?
Why is it a crime for people are
I'm kidding
being
you.
Good citizens, and it's a crime, and they're getting screwed over for living in society like a decent person, while the, you know,
well, let's make that the question of the week.
Yanni,
last thought, please, because we got to wrap up.
Okay, but they say, you know, fool me once, good for you, fool me twice. You know, then, you know, now we know that's what we have achieved with the Occupy movement, that now the cat, not Cat Waters, the cat is out in the loose. We know what's going on. They know we know. I've covered 3 Bloomberg conferences on hedge funds, and their number one question is, they try to address Occupy. They are scared, and we need to amplify our voice.
Well, thank you, Yanni. Thank you, Catherine. Thank you, Glenn Greenwald, for joining us earlier. Thank you, Progressive Network, for being here, the Progressive PRN that's doing so much to bring information to the public. You can reach me at dissector@mediachannel.org. You can read my blog at newsdissector.net. Every day online, I try to follow the news. My film Plunder, The Crime of Our Time, is about the financial crisis, and that's something that I really encourage you to check out. My new book is Dissecting Occupy Wall Street. I'll be at the Left Forum tomorrow at 3 p.m. with Yanni and others. I hope you'll join us, and thank you again for joining us here on PRN FM.